Invitation for an emerging left-right alliance. Barney Frank, Congressman Barney Frank, left, and Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul, libertarian, got together in 2010 to develop a caucus against a bloated military budget and the militarism that comes from it. That's an example in Congress of a far larger number of left-right convergences being repressed by their leadership, which has other corporate campaign cash incentives in mind. So what we're seeing here, listen, even after 9/11, there was a public opinion poll saying that we shouldn't do war on Afghanistan. We should pursue the backers of 9/11, bring them to justice, but not this massive invasion of Afghanistan. And for years, left-right public opinion polls have said we should get out of Afghanistan. So there is a large emerging left-right alliance here against militarism. It was against the invasion of Iraq by Bush and Cheney, the unconstitutional criminal invasion of Iraq. You had over 300 retired generals, admirals, national security leaders, and diplomats speaking out against it before the invasion in March 2003, and they were Republicans and Democrats. So there is this huge potential here to turn this country around. I don't sugarcoat the obstacles in this book, Unstoppable. I go into them one after the other, and how we can overcome them, and how we can establish a new political realignment here. We have enough historical precedent of successful left-right breakthroughs. We've got a breakthrough to the political and electoral sphere here, and start turning the country around.
Ralph Nader, I want to thank you very much for being with us. A longtime consumer advocate, presidential candidate, has written a new book. It's called Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Nate Felser, Armando Nemi, Shakespeare, Martino, Sam Offer, Hani Masood, Arbi Karandina Guzder. I'll be speaking at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, Friday night. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Momenta, Monday, April 28th at the Clinton Street Theater. Momenta is a film and a movement to educate, raise awareness, and activate communities to stop all proposed coal exports in the Pacific Northwest. There will be a raffle after the film and a Q&A with people from the film. Again, that's Monday, April 28th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Un toast aux exploités pour l'extermination des exploiteurs. Une épitaphe pour quelques copains.
The Union of Time Thieves is a monthly exploration of urban life. In this installment, we will be using one of the Situationist International's most beloved techniques to create a revised look at Portland's cityscape. Join us for one entire hour dedicated to détournement, fugitives, and refugees on the Union of Time Thieves on April 28th from 10 to 11 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.
Time is 5:03, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio. Up next is the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mobilizing Local Culture, a University of Oregon Arts Management workshop in Portland, June 23rd through June 28th. Showcasing the ways in which local culture mobilized to make a difference in neighborhoods across the city. More information can be found online at aad.uoregon.edu/summerintensive. And this program has also been made possible by the League of Women Voters of Portland, helping to make democracy work with election forums for the May primary. The April 29th forum will present Multnomah County and Metro candidates. Information can be found online at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a mayor in Ukraine was shot as unrest continues in the region.
A local group launches a campaign to stop Nike from printing offensive Native American mascot images.
And Portland restaurant owners voluntarily decide to raise their workers' minimum wage to $15 an hour. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News from Monday, April 28th, 2014. I'm Mike Klepfer.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Tensions were high in Ukraine today after the mayor of Kharkiv was shot and critically wounded. The mayor of Ukraine's second largest city, Gennady Kernis, was shot in the back while biking on a highway. He was taken to a hospital where he underwent surgery. Doctors said his wounds were life-threatening. Ukrainian activists were also attacked by pro-Russian supporters at a rally in the city today. Kharkiv has been largely spared from popular unrest seen by Kiev and its neighbor, Donetsk. Ukraine's acting governor is attempting to quell pro-Russian separatist forces fighting in skirmishes with armed pro-Russian militias who have taken over government buildings and set up barricades in the country's east. The United States today announced new economic sanctions against prominent Russians. The U.S. and its Western allies have accused Russia of instigating the unrest, a claim which Russian President Vladimir Putin has vehemently denied. Late last week, the new Ukrainian prime minister said that he was willing to start World War III in order to get Crimea back from Russia.
A nationwide social media campaign calling on Nike Corporation to stop selling products featuring the Cleveland Indians mascot, Chief Wahoo, was launched today in Portland. Robert Rocha, the executive director of the Cleveland American Indian Education Center, spoke today to KABU about the issue of Native American mascots, particularly the Cleveland Indians.
The issue is that it's derogatory, demeaning, racist, and absolutely offends us. It offends our spirituality. So, for example, the red feather that the so-called Native American Wahoo wears is a feather that's only given to warriors that have shed their own blood in battle, natives. And so it's given by spiritual leaders, by the chief, it's given by warriors, and it's a part of our religion. It's an eagle feather. The character, which is truly what it means, it's a gross misrepresentation of an individual or an object. Is demeaning because we're not cartoon characters, we're not a mascot, and our children are not mascots. So the one prior to the Wahoo mascot that they came out with a really beady-eyed, hook-nosed, buck-toothed character that I really don't think anybody could say with a straight face that it honors us. That does not honor us. And most importantly, if you're going to honor anybody, you really want to get their approval on it. And, of course, that never happened. They simply tell us that we should be happy. They're honoring us. As a matter of fact, at the last demonstration that we had at Progressive Field, I encountered a gentleman that was dressed in a gaudy outfit with white paint on him, on his face, and with an exaggerated outline of his teeth and his mouth. And the first thing I said to him is, you realize how ridiculous you look? And he said, I'm honoring you. And I said, don't honor us. You're not honoring us. I couldn't engage him in any kind of dialogue, so I just parted. He went his way and I went my way. But I understand this particular fan because I truly believe he was brought up believing that they're actually honoring Native Americans. But could you imagine an African American with white face or a white face with black face at any type of function, there would be a problem, an absolute problem. We just don't understand why people can think it's okay to do that to Native Americans, because it's not.
A group of Native people and their allies...
A
group of Native people and their allies from across the country called, quote, Eradicating Offensive Native American Mascotry, has initiated a, quote, Twitter storm using the hashtag DChief to bring greater attention to the use of Chief Wahoo and other sports mascots. The mascots in question use Native American images and caricatures that many find offensive and disrespectful. The group also planned to hold demonstrations across Nike at their headquarters in Beaverton. Earlier today, KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke with the group's spokesperson, Jacqueline Keeler, based in Portland.
We deal with what we call Twitter storms, which are basically where we try to trend a hashtag. And for a small population like Native Americans in this country, it means a lot that we can be heard. And so we're using social media as a way to be heard and to get our concerns heard to a larger audience. And certainly the whole Native mascot issue has been an issue for my entire life. I mean, my parents protested Chief Wahoo back in the 60s when they were college students before I was born. And it's still going on today. Cleveland had its own AIM, American Indian Movement, which was started by Russell Means, and then also starting of organizations like the Cleveland American Indian Center to help the community, because, of course, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, once they brought people there, didn't do very much to help them. So the community had to help themselves.
I really like that article you wrote, My Life as a Cleveland Indian.
Yes, yeah. I'm pretty sure my parents knew the gentleman there who had to face off with that fan, the Cleveland Indian fan dressed up like Chief Wahoo. And so we're going to do a Twitter storm on Saturday night and Sunday night and attempt to trend the hashtag DChief. Actually, it was started by Cleveland fans who were actually going and removing, cutting out the Chief Wahoo mascot from their Cleveland baseball team apparel, actually taking a knife and cutting it out of the hats and off of the jerseys. And then they take a picture of it, and then they post it online on Twitter or social media, and they include a hashtag that says DChief. So we are going to try to trend that this weekend, and we're working with the Cleveland fans as well. And then we're doing a protest, since I live here in Portland, doing a protest at the Nike World headquarters.
When is that protest going to be?
We're still working on the date, but it's going to be either Thursday or Friday, and we want to do it when the employees are arriving or leaving, so they can see us. It's going to be in front of the gates. You know, Nike has a certain persona it likes to present, and certainly they host the Nike in 7 conferences every year in Beaverton at their world headquarters, where they bring in Native athletes and leaders from all over the country for a whole week of activities, and they make a shoe that's specially designed for Native American feet. Eventually, we would like to get them to stop selling all Native mascot-related gear.
Give us an idea of some other images that they use.
Yeah, they definitely sell the Washington, D.C. football team's gear. And I think, as I write in my article, that I actually made up the word Native masketry, because what bothers me is not just the static image of the mascot. You know, the Washington team's mascot is rather prosaic, but then you compare that to Chief Wahoo, and it's just a complete caricature. So the issue is what the fans do with it and what kind of stereotypes the image promotes, the mascot promotes. To me, those are really pretty horrific. I mean, I can't imagine living in Washington, D.C. and having to confront that all the time. We moved away from Cleveland when I was still a preschooler. And, you know, when I was riding the Max, and this is when it was still PGE Park, and they were having sort of a thing where fans were supposed to come and wear their baseball gear for their favorite team. And I was sitting on the Max with my family. I have 2 small children, and my husband is Iroquois. I'm Navajo and Yankton Sioux. So we're a Native American family, and we're sitting on the Max, and we get to the, and there's a white family sitting across from us. And the father has on his little girl's head a Chief Wahoo hat, baseball cap. And I was horrified because it had been years since I'd seen that image. I don't really recall seeing it as a small child, but I was just horrified because it was so grotesque. And I asked him to remove it because my children were sitting staring at her, you know, and it was just pretty horrific. And he refused. And I explained to him that I was born in Cleveland as well, but that out here on the West Coast, you know, we got rid of Sambo restaurants, and we got you people that we just don't do that sort of thing. You know, he told us to move to somewhere else on the Max. Yeah, that's the kind of reaction we get from the fans.
So have you been in touch with anyone from Nike?
Not yet. We put the press release out today. The Oregonian just did a write-up about it that they just posted today as well, and some of the national Native news organizations. And I will be on David Zirin from The Nation. He has a show called The Edge of Sports. The radio show. I'll be on that on Thursday talking about it as well.
Yeah, and I know you've been on KBOO's fairly new Rose City Native Radio program a couple weeks ago. So people can go to that at kboo.fm, look up that show and get the complete interview. I think it was about a half an hour or so.
And we also have a webpage, eonm.org.
And again, that's EONM for Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry. Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Jacqueline Keeler, for speaking with us today.
Yes, thank you.
And with KBOO News, this is Paul Rowland.
Sponsors of the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team have begun to sever their ties with the franchise after a recording of racist remarks purportedly by team owner Donald Sterling surfaced this weekend. State Farm Insurance, Kia, and Virgin American Airlines, among several others, announced they would no longer do business with the team. The remarks, leaked online anonymously, appear to contain a conversation between Sterling and his girlfriend, where he is exasperated that she brings African American guests to Clippers games and appears with them in photos on social media. The National Basketball Association has pledged to investigate the incident, while the head of the players' union urged the league to impose the heaviest sanctions they could against Sterling. Sterling, a billionaire real estate mogul, was involved in the largest housing discrimination suit in U.S. history, paying $2.7 million to the Justice Department for discriminating against Black and Latino tenants. He has also previously been sued for workplace discrimination and sexual harassment, with former employees describing a litany of racist remarks Sterling made to them in depositions for those suits. In 2009, former team manager Elgin Baylor said that Sterling once likened his team to a slave plantation. Los Angeles Clippers players turned their warm-up jerseys inside out, obscuring the team logo before a playoff loss to the Golden State Warriors on Sunday.
The Portland Police have issued a brief report on the progress of reforms stipulated by the U.S. Justice Department. The Bureau says that it will create a new unit where officers will focus on individuals with mental health problems to whom officers respond to frequent emergency calls about, and that 52 officers had volunteered to be involved with the initiative. The reports also said that officers have been trained in the department's new use of force and taser policy and are looking at ways to further revise those policies. The police bureau, its rank-and-file union, the city, and federal government are still in negotiations to determine the shape of a settlement to a 2012 suit brought by the Justice Department. The suit found the Portland police showed a pattern of using excessive force on people with mental health problems and those perceived to by officers. The report also said that taser use by Portland police was excessive. A conference call between the parties to discuss the bureau's progress was scheduled for this afternoon.
While the debate over a $15 minimum wage is heating up Portland's May 20th primary, some restaurant owners in Southeast Portland are moving ahead on their own. Restaurateur Tommy Lee recounts how he was inspired by Nick Caleb Rally to voluntarily raise his employees' pay to a minimum of $15 an hour.
Well, I saw one of Nick's lecture and saw some of his poster and did some research of my own. I know that's almost impossible to live on minimum wage alone. So I thought something nice to do for the employees is that originally what we pay our employees is $10, a base wage of $10 per hour. And if it's a snow night and they don't make a minimum amount of tips, we'll increase it to $15 an hour. But I managed to convince my dad to increase it to a base wage of just $15 an hour, inspired by Nicholas Caleb's campaign.
Some worry that a $15 an hour minimum wage would be too great a burden for small businesses.
To be honest, not at all, because we just have to cut back on the profits and stuff, but doesn't really affect us at all. We didn't have to increase our prices or anything, so.
Mr. Lee's employees are looking forward to the new wage guarantee.
They are loving it so far. We haven't really started yet, because we're going to start doing that at the beginning of May, but they love the idea of it so far.
That was restaurateur Tommy Lee. He was inspired by Nick Caleb's campaign to guarantee his employees a minimum wage of $15 an hour. Reporting for KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
The state of Washington and the federal government continued the dispute about who's responsible for the cleanup at the Hanford nuclear site, with Washington Governor Jay Inslee filing an official complaint against the feds today. The state of Washington recently rejected the U.S. Department of Energy's proposal to amend a federal court agreement governing cleanup of the Hanford nuclear reservation. The March 31st proposal would have extended the timetable for cleanup by eliminating many deadlines for key project milestones. Hanford, for decades, made plutonium for nuclear weapons and now is engaged in cleaning up the nation's largest volume of radioactive wastes near Richland, Washington. The cleanup is governed by a federal court consent decree reached in 2010 that sets strict milestones for the cleanup process. But the Energy Department has said it is in danger of missing many of those milestones because of the scientific complexity of the work. The consent decree set deadlines for emptying some of Hanford's underground waste tanks and is starting to treat up to 56 million gallons of nuclear waste at the waste treatment plant. But the Energy Department has said most of the remaining deadlines are at risk of being missed, including having the cleanup work completed by 2022.
According to a new report from Friends of the Earth, the companies profiting from the sale and use of pesticides known to be killing the bees and pollinators have started a PR spin to help prevent any pending legislation that would try to protect the bees. The report says that Bayer, Syngenta, and Monsanto, the companies that manufacture the pesticides that have been proven to be killing the bees, are trying to confuse the facts. The companies claim to be concerned about the bee loss, but blame consumers, farmers, and others instead of the products they manufacture. The Friends of the Earth's report named Follow the Honey details how the companies are using tactics used by the tobacco companies in the 60s to promote doubt about the disastrous effects of neonicotinoids on bees and other pollinators. Bees are responsible for two-thirds of the global food production. Over 140 crops, including all corn, and most soy, wheat, and canola seeds are pre-treated with neonics, even though these pesticides are not proven to increase crop yield. High levels of neonicotinoids have been found to kill bees outright, while lower doses are responsible for disorienting bees and interfering with their communication and navigation, resulting in colony collapse. In 2013, the European Commission banned the three most used neonics for a two-year period while studies continue. According to the report, noted food industry critic Michelle Simon, these companies are spending a fortune on advertising campaigns that attack regulators, target children, blame farmers, and pretend to care by establishing campaigns to, quote, save the bees.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Stanley Cohen, the New York-based civil rights lawyer facing 18 months in jail for obstructing the IRS. At 6, it's Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. From 7 to 8 tonight, KBOO's Don Merrill hosts a live candidate forum for prospective Oregon state representatives. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partially cloudy, with a high in the upper 70s and a 10% chance of rain. Our friends at radcast.org have stopped producing daily radiation counts due to a lack of volunteer support. If you're interested in helping with the citizen-led radiation count, contact the organizers at radcast.org. Today in history, in 1967, Muhammad Ali refused army induction, and in 1970, Richard Nixon approved the Cambodian incursion.
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
He's back, and this time he has eyeglasses. Yes, Rick Oops Perry is back, pitching himself for another presidential run. What fun! Who can forget the Texas governor's nationally televised pratfall during a 2011 presidential debate when he couldn't remember the third federal agency he intended to axe? Well, he later sniffed, if anybody's looking for the smoothest debater, I readily admit I'm not that person. But Rick, you weren't debating. You were simply trying to recite your own three talking points. One, two, oops. And the issue isn't whether you're smooth, but whether you're stupid. Way too stupid to be president of the United States of America. That's a role in which this Texan would need to match wits, not with such lame brains as Rick Santorum or Michelle Bachmann, but Vladimir Putin. But wait, there's a new Rick. As mentioned, this go-round, he's sporting black frame designer eyeglasses, which his makeover consultants insist make him look smarter. Actually, the bespectacled Perry looks like a guy squinting at the thermostat to see if he can get his IQ up to room temperature. This is the governor who's been hunkered down for 14 years as the chief executive of the state with the highest percentage of people with no health coverage, the second highest percentage of children with no health insurance, and numero uno in the nation for women without coverage. Then, when Obamacare was made available to provide insurance for millions of Texans, this Mensa in eyeglasses said, "Hell no, we don't need no government-provided health benefits." This is Jim Hightower saying, "We?" For his entire 30-year career in political office, Perry and family have gladly accepted platinum-level health benefits from the government for themselves. I'm guessing that even those $500 glasses he's wearing were put on the taxpayer's tab.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
More than 20 years after it went offline, a crowdfunding effort is underway to reactivate a NASA satellite. The International Sun Earth Explorer 3 satellite was launched on August 12, 1978. Its mission was to study the interaction between the Earth's magnetic field and solar wind. In 1997, NASA ended the mission and ordered the probe shut down. The crowdfunding effort uses the idea to use a radio telescope and software emulator of the original to contact and reactivate the hibernating probe. According to the project team, the probe will be contacted in May, and a complete orbital maneuver will be completed by mid-June.
The Department of Homeland Security is advising Americans not to use Internet Explorer due to its security flaw that came to light over the weekend. Microsoft confirmed Saturday that it is working to fix the code that allows Internet Explorer versions 6 through 11 to be exploited by vulnerability. According to the firm NetMarketShare, 55% of PC computers run one of those versions of Internet Explorer.
Last week's announcement by the Federal Communications Commission that the agency would approve a, quote, tiered internet has raised a firestorm of controversy from internet freedom and civil liberties groups. KBOO's Robin Ryan has more.
Proposed rules to govern internet policy issued by the chairman of the FCC last week means now the focus shifts to the rest of the commission. They'll apply their own proposals for how those rules should read. Net neutrality as a doctrine to keep the internet an open and objectively delivered information tool is at the center of controversy as industry demands a tiered market be created and therefore frame the debate in an economic mold. Capitol Hill veteran Michael O'Reilly is the newest member of the commission, beginning his new role as a regulator late last year, though his comments from this discussion with the Free State Foundation earlier this year in March indicate his philosophy on regulatory authority suggests the less the better.
I start with the premise that championing economic freedom is going to be my guiding principle when overseeing the communications industry. And before regulating, I want to look to four factors. One, does the commission have authority in a particular area, and what are the confines of that authority? Two, when it does act, and what it should be based on is there evidence of market failure and harm to consumers and a solution that it can propose that actually can be implemented? Three is, does the commission set forth its recommendations to be narrowly tailored to the set of providers and services, or is it trying to be expansive in that universe? And then four, do the benefits outweigh the cost of regulations? And let's face facts. The costs are always passed on to consumers in one fashion or another.
Okay, so having in mind your philosophy. And by the way, I sympathize with the condition of the...
O'Reilly began his career in political circles in the mid-1990s as a legislative aide to Thomas Bliley and has since spent years as policy advisor for Republican members of the Senate, specifically for Senators John Kyle from Arizona and John Cornyn representing Texas. Here he speaks to the limits and the intentions of Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996.
At best, Congress intended that Section 706 would be treated as congressional findings. And at worst, absolute worst, would be that it would lead to further deregulatory measures. There was no intention to provide the SEC extra regulatory authority. Heck, even the FCC did not believe that it had this authority until it ran out of other options. In 2010, the D.C. Circuit rejected every shred of authority the commission put forward to regulate net neutrality, to impose net neutrality rules. In a last-ditch effort, you can say, the commission decided to reinterpret Section 706A and then pull the trigger on Section 706B. I find that to be incredibly troubling.
Reporting for KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Officials in Washington are ending their search for victims still unaccounted for in last month's landslide in the town of Oso. The official death toll of the mudslide stands at 41. Rescuers managed to save 11 people from the mile-long search area. Two people are still unaccounted for. The Snohomish County Executive Commissioner has said the county will appoint an independent commission to investigate, while transportation officials said that it may take another 3 months to clear debris.
14 people are reportedly dead and 100 injured after tornadoes struck Arkansas yesterday as a powerful storm system made its way across the Mid-Atlantic region. Two more people, one in Oklahoma and one in Iowa, were also killed. The deaths mark the first in this year's tornado season in the U.S. The storm system is making its way towards Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, but the National Weather Service says there will be no tornadoes in those states as the storm moves east. However, they said a tornado warning remains in effect in the Mid-Atlantic.
The Afghan presidential race is set for a June runoff between former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah and former World Bank economist Ashraf Ghani, according to official results released Saturday. The preliminary tally showed Abdullah winning nearly 45% of the 6.9 million votes cast and Ghani 31.5%. Election officials will examine hundreds of reports of voting irregularities before issuing final results on May 14th, but the allegations didn't appear widespread enough to change the results substantially or to give Abdullah the absolute majority needed to avoid a runoff. An investigation is underway to find out why a British military helicopter crashed in southern Afghanistan, killing five troops. The Lynx helicopter crashed during a routine flight in Kandahar province on Saturday, causing the third biggest single loss of life for British troops in the country.
In the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, six Palestinian youths, including a teenager, were abducted by the army on Monday from the districts of Hebron and Bethlehem. Israeli forces stormed Beit Awa town to the southwest of Hebron and the illegal in the town of Beit Umar, located to the north of Hebron. One 17-year-old was served with a notice to appear for interrogation before the Israeli intelligence in Gush Etzion, a group of illegal Israeli settlements located near Bethlehem following a raid on his house in Bethlehem. Late Sunday night, soldiers stationed at Al-Karamech Crossing kidnapped a 20-year-old resident of Hebron. Forces also invaded the Hisha refugee camp located to the south of Bethlehem, kidnapping one 22-year-old after raiding and searching his house. The army also stormed Zatara town to the east of Bethlehem, where they abducted a 25-year-old young man after breaking into and searching his house. Also on Monday, Israeli police assaulted a number of laborers bound for work in Israel. Israeli settlers on Monday surrounded a Palestinian farmer as he grazed the sheep on his own land in the village of Wadi Rahal near Bethlehem, where they prevented him from returning home.
An Egyptian judge has sentenced 683 men to death in Egypt's latest mass trial. It was a second mass death sentence imposed by Saeed Yousef, who imposed a death sentence on 530 men last month. The sentences are related to popular unrest in Egypt, dating back to last year when residents of the town of Minya killed a policeman. Today, Yousef upheld the death sentence for 37 of those convicted in March, commuting the rest of the sentences to 25 years in prison. He also banned the liberal April 6 Youth Movement, a group instrumental in the 2011 popular uprising which ousted former dictator Hosni Mubarak. The mass trials have been roundly criticized by international human rights observers. Egyptian authorities have cracked down on popular dissent since the ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi, former military head Abdel Fattah al-Sisi this year stepped down to potentially stand for election. The U.S. began resupplying the Egyptian air military earlier this month.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalind Scott, Paul Rowland, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Joe Meyer. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Mike Klepfer.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hear the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9, on alternative radio, poet Martin Espada speaks on remembering well and raising hell. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Dennis Bernstein hosts Flashpoints, investigative news radio. At 11, Stage and Studio is off today. Instead, Bruce Silverman interviews Bill Carter about his book, Boom, Bust, Boom, an expose of copper mining. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Scott Fife, scenic designer for Portland Center Stage's current production of Othello, and Fred Chaining, the technical director at Portland Center Stage. They talk about the challenges and process of designing and building theater sets. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO FM and donating, clicking on Donate Today.
And now stay tuned for a live interview conducted by a KBOO reporter.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Stanley Cohen, an activist lawyer, and represented a number of controversial clients, including the son-in-law of Osama bin Laden and the political party Hamas. And most recently, you have been... you've got a case against you by the IRS and have agreed to a plea deal. Can you tell us about that case against you?
We know that this investigation has its roots going back more, almost a decade, in an investigation by a prosecutor elsewhere for material support for terrorism. under a theory that my work representing the political wing of Hamas may have crossed the line. We know through a series of former clients and clients of mine that for years, whenever Palestinian clients were being interrogated or arrested or harassed, my name came up, and persons were basically told that they could get a get-out-of-jail card free if they inculpated me or involved me in something. So the investigation has its roots in a political investigation going back years that ended up going nowhere. It eventually ended up in the hands of the IRS. We know, as has been exposed increasingly over the last few years, for being involved in a host of political persecutions, groups, investigations based upon the politics of individuals and political movements. And after many years of an investigation with grand jury subpoenas and court arguments and lawsuits and counter-lawsuits, I ended up getting charged at first in the Northern District of New York with impeding the tax code, which, if you can figure that out and let me know what it means, I'd appreciate it, because some of the best legal talent in the country hasn't been able to figure it out. And then when we told them to go to hell on that, the Southern District of New York turned around, even though I'm a taxpayer solely in the Southern District, and added a series of misdemeanor counts for failure to file the final reports for a five-year period. Even though in each of the years projected reports had been filed, projected figures had been submitted, and projected payments had been made. So we eventually decided, after years and years and years of fighting and enormous costs that were running up into $500,000-$600,000, of which a good chunk is owed, and the specter of several years' worth of trials and possible appeals, and the government increasingly targeting family members of mine, that we were going to put this to bed and fight it in a different way. And that's why we agreed upon a disposition in the Northern District of New York, not for income tax evasion, as has been misreported by some of the mainstream media. It's for impeding the IRS.
Are you aware of other people that have been charged with impeding the IRS? How unusual is this charge? It just sounds really strange.
Well, the legislative history of impeding the IRS finds its roots when the Internal Revenue Code was first enacted, and the revenuers would travel to people's homes to help them with their taxes and to tell them they had to make payments. This statute was passed to protect agents who, not surprisingly, were often met with a lot of anger and at times of violence. It was really designed to protect tax collectors from interference, and physical interference at that, by targets of investigations. Now, there's none of that that's alleged here. The government theory is very interesting. And I mean, anyone who knows me, you know, knows the work that I've done for 30 years, I may be anything, but I'm certainly not a businessman. Government theory, which includes impeding the tax code because I engaged in barter in my law practice. So if someone's kid got busted for a pound of pot and I represented them for free and they came and painted my office because it wasn't declared as income, it's impeding the tax code. Or by making payments for work done by investigators in cash as opposed to a check, it's impeding the tax code. Getting payments in cash at any time is impeding the tax code. The theory is, in essence, that the way I maintained my practice was such was that it impeded with the ability of the IRS to monitor my revenue stream for the five-year period, although there's no claim that there's any tax evasion, and they've spent years looking for, you know, the mountain of gold and haven't found a penny, but a lot of debt and a lot of pro bono work. To answer your question, no, I know of very few, if any, other persons charged with impeding the IRS.
Well, it sounds like there was a fishing expedition out to try to find something on you. You said initially they were looking to find material support for terrorism. They were unable to find that. And similarly, one of your clients, actually from here in Portland, Sheikh Mohammed Kariyeh from the Islamic Center here in Portland, had a similar witch hunt done on him. And I wonder, it just because there's a local connection, if you could talk a little bit about Korea's case.
Sure. I did a lot of work for the Muslim community in Portland 7, 8, 9 years ago, and in fact still do with some members of the community. Sheikh Karier's case in particular was one in which the government targeted him. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Portland targeted him because he was the religious leader of a masjid, of a mosque locally, which they believed through the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is notorious for misinformation and disinformation, that particular masjid in general and the sheikh in particular played some role in the Portland, I think, 7 or 9 case, which I also represented someone in. And they were giving people get-out-of-jail cards free if they could involve Sheikh Karier, who had nothing to do with that investigation. And they targeted him for a number of years, looked everywhere for anything they could find, eventually arrested him for trace elements of explosives, allegedly, on getting on an airplane, which we proved the system which developed or found or made this conclusion was broken, wasn't operated properly, and it was nothing. But at the end of the day, during the course of the investigation, they determined that he had made some alleged misstatements for some social services, and rather than calling it a day and just dropping the whole case out of a sense of embarrassment and with a sense of justice, he, in essence, was forced to take a plea to dispose of the case with a relatively minor disposition involving some reports that had been filled out for social service, got some probation, and moved on. But he's the classic example of how investigations are started by the Joint Terrorist Task Force that target political persons, that go after people they believe represent an opposition to their agenda and their view of what's correct or not. And when it doesn't lead them where they want it to, they drag anything and everything else in.
Do you feel that the charges against you are an attempt to silence you and to impede your practice and maybe have other lawyers who are thinking about representing controversial clients decide not to do so? Do you think it'll have a chilling effect?
Well, I'd like to think it won't have a chilling effect, but clearly this 7, 8, 9, 10-year witch hunt was designed to break me. As I said, it cost to take the government on this level, to take them on, you know, it's $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 in expenses. The kind of money that I hundreds of thousands of dollars are owed. They have endless resources. It's designed to take your time from your practice, to force you to focus on other things, to break you financially, to slander your name, to send a message to clients, this is what happens if you're represented by this guy, and yes, to scare other attorneys. I'd like to think that attorneys will continue to fight the good fight. We made a decision, and I know there are a lot of friends and supporters that were a little bit surprised that we decided to dispose of this matter the way we did after all this time, but we made a decision that to continue to fight this with the level field being so uneven for as long as we had was continuing to play into their hands. So we decided to put this to bed, to end this, and to move on.
Are you worried about having to spend time in prison now?
No. It'll ultimately be up to a judge in the Northern District of New York, a judge who I have had a very, I've had a number of cases in front of for a number of years. We plan on articulating our concern that this was politically rooted and it was harassment and that I'd been singled out and selected. One person said the last person in the world that the Bureau of Prisons wants in jail is Stanley Cohen. I'm not worried. If I end up doing some jail time, I'll end up, I've said before, I'd rather spend, 18 months in prison than go to dinner with just about anyone in any federal courtroom at any time. it will be what it will be. It'll go where it goes. The work will continue. Part of this effort has been to as I say, to slow me down, to tie up the practice, and to some degree to go after my ability to maintain my law license, which ultimately will be the major thrust of the battle at some point down the road.
Well, KBOO listeners are, I'm sure, familiar with the case of Lynn Stewart, who we have covered extensively as another activist lawyer. You also have a connection with Lynn, and I wonder if you have, if you think your cases are comparable in some ways.
Well, Lynn and I shared office space and were de facto partners for many years. We did a lot of work together. We did a lot of cases together. I was her lawyer in a state court prosecution for contempt and couldn't represent her in federal court because I was a potential witness. I think there's a lot in common. Both had their genesis in political persecution. Both had their genesis in political prosecution. Both had their genesis in targeting lawyers who had spent their careers in fighting the government, particularly this industry called the War on Terror. Both had made a name for many, many years of speaking out on behalf of the despaired and the despised and the disaffected. And we had both been very successful, I think, over the years in fighting for the little guy, the little gal, and had never been intimidated by the government. So I think there's a common thread, absolutely. Clarence Darrow, and I'm certainly no Clarence Darrow, but said himself, having been indicted and prosecuted and went to trial, he said a very long time ago, 100 years ago or more, you show me a lawyer who spends his or her lifetime representing the powerless and the despised and the despaired, who themselves has never been charged or indicted, and I'll show you a failure. You know, power goes after those people that challenge power. That's what happened with Lynn. That's what's happened with me. There are no shortage of attorneys in this country, political attorneys. You had another attorney in Portland, Oregon, who was arrested and detained and held for I don't know how long, for weeks, and the wild allegations of being involved in a so-called terrorism bombing in Madrid, who ended up being set up and cleared, and there was a huge lawsuit. He was completely vindicated. And there again was the Joint Terrorism Task Force. He was a young lawyer who was increasingly involved in advocating for and on behalf of and representing members of the Muslim community. He was targeted.
That's the case of Brandon Mayfield.
There's a connection among lawyers that get singled out and the work that they do.
And do you think that that it's a logical thing in a society such as the one that we are living in right now, that people like yourself, who are essentially the folks from the 60s who maintained their principles throughout, are ending up in prison at this time?
Well, no, it's interesting because if you take a look, you know, we have the first African American president, a self-professed progressive, someone who came into office, was swept into office under a theory of a clean break, a new administration, a new approach, who has turned out to be one of the most repressive presidents in certainly modern history. He has completely co-opted and politicized the Department of Justice. He's turned it into an enforcement mechanism that singles out whistleblowers and dissidents and political activists, made enormous promises about Gitmo and about the droning policies and about how we were going to deal with the prison population, which remains largely people of color, largely people charged with victimless crimes, largely people convicted and put in prison for drug offenses. And what's interesting is, in the light of the last 6 years or 7 years with the passage of the NDAA and with more and more whistleblowers being singled out and prosecuted and more secrecy and more political prosecutions, it's obvious that this is an administration that has embraced the notion of coming for its enemies, done so in ways that I do not recall even since the days of Richard Nixon. So you're right. I think that there are many women and men now in their 50s and 60s who came out of an era where we embraced certain beliefs and we've tried to lead a life consistent with those beliefs, who increasingly are being targeted.
Wow. And I just want to ask something from your critics' perspective. They say that you're always looking for a general commonality of ground with your clients. And one of your main clients has been the political wing of Hamas, a group that has in the past targeted civilians. How do you feel a commonality with a group like Hamas?
Hamas is a national liberation movement. Hamas is an organization that for over 20 years has been the primary group to defend the aspirations, the rights, and the safety of the Palestinian people. National liberation movements are recognized under international law. It tends to be the same people. You remember that Nelson Mandela was one of the world's leading terrorists for 27 years. And toward the end of his life, he only came off the foreign designated terrorist organization or individual list in 2008. You couldn't find anyone who didn't want a photo op with him. It tends to be a fine line between freedom fighter and terrorist, and it's who wins. The United States has been supporting the good al-Qaeda in the U.S. view in Syria for the last 3 or 4 years. I see Hamas as an organization committed to the liberation of Palestine that has been the prime mover in defending the rights of 11 million Palestinians that are stateless, that live 4 million of whom live under occupation and apartheid, subjected to collective punishment and ethnic cleansing every day. And so my critics, I stand absolutely shoulder to shoulder with many friends in Hamas. I've known the leadership of Hamas for many years. I don't think there's a founder who I do not know, most of whom have now been assassinated. And I call them brothers and I call them sisters with pride. And the notion that Hamas is just an armed movement that has engaged in acts of violence is silly. In 2006, there was an election. They won millions of votes. Hamas is not just a handful of fighters. It's the spirit of millions of Palestinians in refugee camps and in Palestine who are resisting. And resistance is a recognized right under international law.
You also filed a lawsuit in 2002 against Israel. What was that about?
Yeah, I filed a lawsuit in 2002 against Israel, against the United States, against weapons manufacturers, against fundraisers and various settlement groups under a theory that they were engaged in crimes against humanity, genocide, and violating the Arms Export Control Act. It was a suit that I didn't think we would prevail upon, and ultimately we did not, but nonetheless it was a suit that had to be brought. It was important. The issues were important. I find it interesting that, you know, years later, Israel or Israelis have used the sort of same legal theory to try to go after Palestinian organizations and entities and other resistance groups in the world. And there they're finding receptive venues in federal courts, and we did not. Basically, the sovereign immunity theory and qualified sovereign immunity theories knocked us out of court. It was a suit that continued on. I'm currently involved with another 4 lawsuits against Israel overseas, one in Spain, one in Morocco, one in the International Criminal Court that's been pending for a while, one in the Court of The Hague. We're contemplating some additional ones as we speak. So, yeah, I've been suing Israel and the United States for many years. And, you know, the cynics would suggest that there might be some connection between that litigation and my investigation.
Well, and we will leave it at that. I've been speaking with Stanley Cohen. He is an attorney, an activist, and a criminal defense attorney who has, as he said, been targeted by the IRS and now charged with impeding the IRS and may be having to serve some jail time because of that. His website is istanleycohen.org. I know that you're trying to get some help with legal costs there. And if people want to find more information, they can go to that website, istanleycohen.org. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Stanley Cohen.
Thanks for inviting me, and a hearty shout out to your wonderful audience in Oregon, one of my favorite states in the country.
Well, thank you. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
Gandhi said the roots of your destiny are in your beliefs.
Join Prison Pipeline on May 12th for a one-hour special called This I Believe.
We are women sharing deeply held beliefs that guide our lives. We are women incarcerated at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline, May 12th, 6 to 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along on Saturday, May 3rd, from 3 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. On what would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday, his life and legacy will be honored with song, remembrances, and a talk by Joe Hickerson. Again, that's Saturday, May 3rd, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. 10 days ago, in my report to the nation on Vietnam, I announced the decision...
I'm Jimmy Tardy. Join myself, S. Brian Wilson, and Mike Hasty as we speak with Joe Lewis, survivor of the Kent State shootings. That's on the anniversary of Nixon's announcement of the expansion of the Vietnam War into Laos and Cambodia. The protests at Kent State followed that announcement, and we'll talk with Joe about that day and what it means. That's Wednesday, April 30th from 11 a.m. until noon.
Now, unfortunately, while we deeply sympathize with the plight of 7 million Cambodians whose country has been invaded...
The time is 6:01, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio. Up next is Labor Radio at 6, and at 6:30 it is Prison Pipeline, followed by Hard Knock Radio at 7. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism,